You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon. I'm David Wessel, Director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings. It's my pleasure to welcome you on behalf of the Hutchins Center and also the John Thornton Center on China. You know, once upon a time in my career as a journalist, the conversation about the global economy was largely a conversation about the U.S., with occasional references to Japan or Western Europe. Then came China, an economic miracle, lifted millions of people out of poverty, but still it was a story about China. Today, China is the world's largest trading nation, the second largest economy in the world, and conversations about the global economy often begin by addressing what's going on in China and the impact it's having on the rest of the world and its complex transition to a slower, safer rate of growth, to an economy driven not by exports and investment, but by consumer domestic demand, and by a more market-driven financial system. So in the past several months, we've all learned just how much news about China's economy and its economic policies ricochet around the world, all of which makes today's event particularly timely. We're going to start with a panel with my colleague David Dollar, senior fellow here at Brookings, formerly with the World Bank and the U.S. Treasury in Beijing, Eshwar Prasad, also of Brookings and Cornell University, formerly head of the IMF's China desk. We're very pleased to have Xinjing Gao as a professor at Tsinghua University and formerly the head of China's Investment Corp and really one of the pioneers in bringing securities markets and securities regulation to China. And I'm very pleased that today's panel will be moderated by Lingling Wei, my former colleague at the Wall Street Journal, a star in our Beijing bureau. I'm going to turn it over to Lingling, and I'll be back in about 45 minutes with Yi Gang and Ben Bernanke. Take it away.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you, everyone. It's an honor for me today to moderate such a great panel. Our mission today is to talk about China's changing economy. As most of you know, China's government has been undertaking a massive task of transforming the Chinese economy so that it can be driven more by domestic consumption and less by exports and manufacturing. The government recently released a proposal for its new and 13th five-year plan, which basically will guide the country's social, economic, and political development for the next 5 years, starting this year and through 2020. So my first question is for Mr. Gao. In your view, what are the key messages the leadership is sending through this new five-year plan?
Well, the new five-year plan looks all good and logical and being expected by people. Following the third plenum of the party, 18th Party Congress, the problem is that, you know, other than any other party Congress before, other than all the third plenum of since the 11th Party Congress, every one of them was followed very loyally by our people over the past 30 years. But this time, this is 2.5 years after the third plenum, and after the pronouncement of the of all the reform agenda and all these things, the people were very excited at the time. I myself was very excited about all the agenda on the economic reform and political reform for that matter, and the fourth plenum, which is the rule of law plenum. The problem is that as of today, after 2.5 years, we're still waiting for many of the measures to come out. So the fifth-year plan, the five-year plan, now as we look at it, is still promising and makes all sense. Somehow, we just do not have as much of a confidence in the possibility of its getting implemented in a short period of time. Somehow it gets You know, there's this bifurcating development in the past few years when people see that on the one hand, the government has been very encouraging about innovation, about reform, talking about it a lot, and especially talking about the part that, which I would say as political reform, namely the two lists, we see the negative list and the power list, to, so to speak, to streamline the government policy, and also their constant call on the reform of SOEs. But on the other hand, so far, we haven't seen too many things being done so far, both on the side of the political reform, namely the two lists. We're still waiting for the list to come out. Every government agency is talking about the list, but no one seems to be coming out with a real list. And also at the same time, if you look at the SASAC, which is in charge of all the state-owned enterprises, so far hasn't done much. You know, we keep hearing about the new set of plans for the state enterprise reform. And the only thing we have seen so far in the past few years is the remonopolization of a few industries. That's the negative part. But of course, on the positive side, you can see that in many other ways, especially on the grassroots level, on the private enterprises level, and people are taking more initiative and people are trying to push forward things. And more and more people are coming out and being more vocal about the necessity to reform the state enterprises. But you see this huge tension between those people who are saying, okay, state enterprises are the what they call the founding, the power base of the Communist Party on the one hand. Therefore, the rationale is that we should keep the state enterprise. On the other hand, people are saying, look at these state enterprises. They're so inefficient, and they're in many ways corrupt in one way or the other. And they're not working very hard anyway now with the anti-corruption campaign. So, why do we keep them still as such a big waste of the resources? So, we see on both ways. And my take of it is that it's probably going to take a few more months or a year or two before we can see the prospect of the state enterprise going one way or the other. And then we'll know much better as to whether or not our government is willing and able to put forward this reform blueprint as mapped out by the third plenary.
Thank you very much. Professor Gao pointed out a really interesting trend in China right now. Basically, on one hand, expectations were running so high for reforms, happening at a faster pace under the current administration than years past. But it really hasn't happened yet. And in some aspects, we have seen reforms actually getting dialed back. So, Ashwar, in your view, why is this happening? Why are we seeing, things, reality not meeting up with expectations?
So one interesting thing about the new five-year plan is that it looks a lot like the old five-year plan. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing because many of the problems that China faces are still there and they haven't morphed that much, although the scale and scope of some of the problems have increased quite significantly. But I think Mr. Gao has correctly put his finger on what is the key reform that is needed on the real side, which is state enterprise reform. My view is that over the last year, in fact, the landscape for those reforms has gotten somewhat more complicated. It's not like there were no reforms last year. In fact, if one looks at what happened last year, we didn't have the deposit rate liberalization. We did have the ostensible freeing up of the exchange rate, some capital account opening measures, the establishment of the explicit deposit insurance system. But virtually every one of these reforms is about financial or capital markets. The real side of the economy and institutional reforms, including corporate governance, auditing and accounting standards, regulatory frameworks, all of which are necessary to support a market-oriented environment, those haven't been as much focused on. And this year, I think, is going to be a complicated environment for the real reforms that China needs beyond finance. One of the reasons, of course, is that the economic growth has slowed down, which makes it much harder to generate the appetite for reforms to the state enterprises, which, as Mr. Gao pointed out, still remain a very important part of the economy. In addition, I think last year there were two very well-intentioned steps which turned out to be missteps on the stock market and on the currency that I think have emboldened the reactionary forces that are opposed to reforms. And then one must almost always think in China's context or in any context about the political overlay over the economic reforms. And with a change in high-level positions coming up next year, 2017, I think the jockeying for positions has already begun. And I suspect we'll begin to see senior-level officials either trying to protect their territory or trying to make sure that they don't stir the water or stumble too much by taking aggressive reform measures. So I suspect that one of the reasons we got so much in terms of financial market reforms last year was that there was a very clear framework getting the RMB into the SDR basket. A few boxes had to be ticked. They did tick all of them in a somewhat uneven and haphazard way, but it did get done. And you had a very effective advocate, Governor Zhou. Real side reforms lack that framework. They lack the urgency. And I think the political and economic environment is going to make it very difficult to see significant progress on those real reforms this year, despite the fact that the five-year plan, the state enterprise reform plan, which was put out late last year, all have exactly the right words and intentions in them. But I think it's going to be politically and economically difficult to push forward.
The government seems to be juggling two major tasks at the same time. On one hand, they're trying very hard to prevent a near-term hard landing through expansionary fiscal and monetary policy. The leadership has repeatedly reiterated its desire to carry on reforms, painful reforms. For example, making sure that zombie firms are allowed to go under. David, my question for you is, you know, how do you think the current effort to prevent hard landing is affecting the reform effort?
Okay, thank you very much. So I thought I was going to be the pessimist on this panel, and at least in the first few moments, I find myself being the optimist, okay? So to answer Ling Ling's question, you know, let me put it in this context. You know, I don't disagree with the things that Gao Xiching and Eshwar just said. But I would say that if you go back 3 months or so, all of that was true, plus there was a real worry around the world about a hard landing in China. There had been the missteps in the exchange market. There was worry about an unruly devaluation. And I think in the last couple of months, at the more macro level, the government has done some things to stabilize the situation. You know, first, they've done a better job of communicating that they're trying to manage the exchange rate with reference to a basket. That seems to have calmed markets to some extent. The reserve loss was much lower in March than it had been in previous months. And then, frankly, the dovish stance of the Fed is probably helping out there to some extent. And then, you know, they did marshal some old-style stimulus last year. You know, they approved a lot of investment projects. Partly this is related to the five-year plan. That seems to be kicking in now, and I think we're about to get some better data. Now, I view this as both good news and bad news. You know, the good news is there's a lot of worry about the world economy. The IMF just marked down the forecast for the U.S., for the global economy, for Japan. They actually marked up the forecast for China very modestly to, I think, 6.5. There's a sense that the Chinese economy is stabilizing, and that's a positive thing in the short run. Now, I do think, I think there's both good news and bad news, because I still worry about the same things that Gao Xiching and Eshwar talked about. So I see China as having bought itself an opportunity, a window of opportunity. They need to move ahead on these reforms. They need to close zombie firms, clean up the financial system. One of my favorite reforms is opening up the service sectors to competition. If they move ahead on that agenda, you know, then having bought some time is useful, and we can get a successful transition in China. If, on the other hand, after another 6 or 9 months, there's still this pessimistic sense that they're not really doing the hard reforms, you know, then that ability to keep applying stimulus, I mean, that's going to be of diminishing quality over time.
Thank you. As you mentioned earlier, there was a lot of market turmoil since August last year, actually since June, July last year. And among the conversations we've had with foreign investors and even with foreign rating agencies such as Moody's and Standard Poor's, as you know, recently downgraded the credit outlook for China. And one of the concerns they often cite is policy uncertainty. They're not afraid of market uncertainty, market volatility, but they're very much concerned about the kind of policy uncertainty they have been witnessing since last year. So, Professor Gao, my question for you is that why there is so much policy uncertainty in China? Do you think the government has done enough in terms of better communicate its intentions to the public?
Well, I think the biggest problem really is not as much of what we call policy uncertainty per se, but really the age-old question of political reform. Because, you know, the market hates the most is unpredictability. And over the past 30 years, the Communist Party and the State Council has done a great job in maintaining predictability. So gradually we have more and more predictability. But all of a sudden last year, July, you know, I personally was involved in quite a few of these, what they call saving the market by violence in the past, both in my capacity as a regulator and then as my capacity as a major, you know, state investor. But in the past, it was always contained in a very small group of people in a very particular line of things and a very short period of time. But this time, it just surprised everyone by having such a large scale, so many people get involved, sort of a true violence in saving the market. And then it basically changed the expectations for not only international investors, because we don't really care about those things. Because if you actually look at a number, international investment accounts for less than 1% of the market cap in China. But you know, that's why when it happened last July, when some people came out saying that, oh, this is Americans doing it, American hedge funds trying to sabotage our market, I just laughed. I said, well, look, you know, altogether they have like $30 billion, but our market at the time was already, you know, quite a few trillion dollars worth. But the problem is that the Chinese investors this time, first time for a long time, because the Chinese investors typically never really expected that much of a predictability per se. They always knew that a government is going to do something, but they never knew that a government is going to do something like this. This time, not just the government itself, but really 20-some state-owned or state-controlled securities firms coming into the arena. Every one of them having their managers, their relatives, and all these people coming in. Of course, people say that won't happen. But I think that's, to me, it's not as much a problem as the other side of the issue, which is that the government on the very top, I don't think they meant what these people think, that they just want to totally change the market form. The big leaders are probably saying, okay, our biggest concern is maintain stability. Try to maintain stability. I don't care what you do. But then those people there these are regulators, and the regulators, and of course, this main regulator who are quoted by saying, other than the Constitution, I can change every other law. But of course, now he's in jail for some other reason. But the thing, this is the vice chairman of the regulators. But the problem is that, the fact that these people, this is a very smart person. I know him for a long time. You know, for him to come out in such a bold, fashion to say that he doesn't care about the law, it's the first time in our history of the past 30-some years of reform. So I think somewhere someone up there would have to come out and say, okay, forget it. These people, you cannot run a country like this anymore. You know, the fact that for quite some years the government doesn't come out say this thing. Because during my time in the CSRC, we constantly come out and said, look, the government does not care about the sways of the stock market. It's not our responsibility. We only care about wrongdoings in the market. But now, for a long time, nobody says that anymore. Sounds like the regulators are taking it upon themselves as to what they call the development of the market, namely what they call the bullish market, which would signify their own achievement. That's totally wrong. And I've been quite vocal about it, and people keep warning me. And say, no, don't say that. You know, you're stepping on the shoes of those, the feet of those people. I said, I don't care. You know, the problem is that, you know, the fact that many of these private enterprises are coming out and say, okay, forget it. I'm not investing in America, in Europe, or even in Africa, rather than in China. It's a manifestation of that.
It's really interesting what you said about the responsibilities of Chinese regulators. You know, they're like seems like they have too many goals: protect investors' interest, and also at the same time, you know, trying to get the stock market indices to a certain point.
It's two goals.
Two conflicting goals. Right.
So I keep telling the government, I said, look, you should not ask the regulators to take care of the market development. It's not their responsibility. And their only responsibility is to try to catch the bad guys,
right.
Period.
Right.
So far, nobody comes out and say it, so.
Yeah, we talked about the stock market, and I'd like to get your guys' views on the other very important market, the currency. Because right now, it looks like the yuan has stabilized a little bit, but still, it's a big concern for a lot of investors. What's really happening to China's exchange rate policy these days? You know, is the renminbi another name for the yuan any more market driven today than prior August 11th last year?
I think connecting to Mr. Gao's thoughts about the stock market, I think there is a fundamental tension in how the Chinese government views markets. On the one hand, it does see them as a useful mechanism for the allocation of resources and of determining prices. But on the other hand, it also wants to maintain stability and control, because without stability and control, there is a sense among the regulators that they have failed, or among the government, that somehow something is going wrong and the market gets out of control. Those are two fundamentally contradictory impulses, and I think the tension between them does lead to many stumbles, even when the government has the right intentions. And on the currency, my sense is that the PBOC certainly has the right intentions, although I guess we'll hear more explicitly about this from Mr. Yi Gang shortly. The difficulty, of course, was that the way the August 11th move was implemented created a number of complications, both in terms of capital flow dynamics, capital outflow dynamics in particular, and currency depreciation, which made it very difficult to move towards this objective. So given where they are right now, I think the right solution would be to stabilize investor expectations and rebuild some market confidence, which would require two things. You would need enough macroeconomic stimulus, or at least signs that the economy is heading in the right direction in the short term. And the second would be to re-energize the reform effort so that investors are convinced that the economy is going in the right direction in the long term. Because there are still many good reasons to invest in China. It's still a relatively fast-growing economy. There are many opportunities there. So I view this as a problem that is not so much policy uncertainty which country doesn't have policy uncertainty right now, but it's also the opacity of the policies, the fact that we don't have a sense of what the frameworks is that the government or the central bank is using to think about various issues. Once you have those frameworks sort of laid out in the minds of investors, then it becomes somewhat easier for markets to see the logic of your action because your objectives are clear. So my sense is that we will see the PBOC allowing the currency to float more freely, but the wild card in all of this, as we were discussing earlier, is the dollar. The fact that the dollar weakened over the last month and a half or so has certainly given the PBOC a lot more room in terms of easing pressures on the currency and allowing it to use its flexibility a little more. But if the dollar were to strengthen further from here, especially if the ECB and BOJ were to intervene aggressively to weaken their own currencies, which have been uncomfortably appreciating, that could re-energize the downward pressures on the RMB. But set against that is the fact that the expectations about growth do seem to have stabilized somewhat. Now, views about China do tend to swing wildly from one extreme to the other. So I think we are swinging quite significantly back in the other direction now based on a sliver of positive-looking data, and it could as easily swing easily back. But I suspect that for the remainder of this year, we're going to see relative stability because there are two important events on the calendar. One is the Chinese leadership of the G20 summit that comes up in early September, and then the October 1 accession of the RMB into the SDR basket. And my sense is that China would like to go into both of these on a high note. So barring something extraordinary happening with the dollar, I think we'll see relative stability. And I think the Chinese, the PBOC, using whatever opportunity it can to start allowing the currency to float more freely. But again, there could be lots of bumps and stumbles along the road.
Great. You guys all mentioned that right now, I mean, the past few months, the PBOC has got a helping hand from the Fed because of the dollar kind of weakened a little bit against the euro and the yen, and that helped elevate pressure, weakening the renminbi. So that touches upon another question that, you know, a lot of people within China have been talking about is, should the PBOC and the Fed better communicate each other or even coordinate their actions? David, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, so when I was the U.S. Treasury representative in Beijing, that Treasury position organizes the meetings of the Fed presidents and Fed governors to China. So I organized quite a few of those meetings and sat in on some of the discussions. My experience was there's really quite good communication between the Fed and PBOC. In some ways, it's a less politicized relationship than between the U.S. Treasury, you know, and the Chinese government. The Fed is independent. And my experience in those meetings is, you know, the Fed governors and presidents genuinely interested in finding out about the Chinese economy, the direction of Chinese policy. So I think there's good communication. Of course, it could be better. There had been talk about the two central banks, you know, exchanging more staff, and there's been a little bit of progress, but you know, there could be a lot more. You know, they could do a better job. But I think the communication is basically good, and I think the notion of they should coordinate, I think that's a little bit of an artificial notion. I think Janet Yellen's been very clear that, you know, if events in China affect the global economy and affect the United States, either through financial conditions or the real economy, you know, then, you know, those are factors that the Fed is looking at and making decisions. And if China is not influencing those things, you know, then it's not realistic to think the Fed is going to change policy. I think statutorily, they have to make policy in order to hit a roughly 2% inflation target in the U.S., maximize employment. So I think good communication is already there. Better communication can certainly help. Any sense of coordination, I think, is probably unrealistic.
Yeah, you reminded me of a conversation I recently had with the PBOC official when I posed the same question to him. His response is, China and the U.S. seem to have a hard time agreeing on everything, let alone coordinating their actions on monetary policy. So with that, I'd like to open the floor up to questions. Anyone? Oh, okay. Do we have a mic?
And please introduce yourself. Yeah.
Yes.
My name is Sandra. I'm from Tencent Finance. So I'm from China Press. My question is about the China's banking system, because yesterday IMF basically warning on China's banking risk because it's related to China's corporate debt overhaul. So I want to ask the panels, like, whether do you worry about China's banking risk? And what's your thought about China's strategy to use this kind of debt to equity swap to share the burden among the corporates and the banks? Any suggestions? Thanks.
Professor Gao, would you like to answer this question?
Well, it is a legitimate question, but it's not, as I said earlier, it's not as big an issue as the reform itself. If you look at the things we're talking about, you know, zombie companies, you know, the SOE reforms, and what we call the government plan to try to reduce overcapacity in all the steel industry, in coal, cement, glass, you know, all these things. And today, if you look at the effort going forward, you know, all these years, there have been a lot of effort, and, you know, the Chinese government has been quite smart about these things. But the problem is that the political struggle between the central government and the local government and the competition among all the provinces is such that, in the end of the day, if you don't have a very strong central government really trying to do it, then it won't happen. Only yesterday I heard that the effort to reduce coal production and the steel production finally resolved in this fashion. It says, okay, since we cannot really get rid of all the zombie companies, so for every province, you have to reduce your capacity by 13.3%. Anyway, I don't care how you cut it. So in the end of the day, the local government is probably going to cut as much of zombie companies as on the better company side. So everyone cuts 13.5%. That, you know, to us, that's you know, that doesn't make sense economically, but that's what would happen. So when you actually look at, you know, the corporate debts, and also if you travel, I travel a lot in China, every city you go, you see, you know, huge areas of high rises with nobody living in there, you know, especially on the third, fourth line cities. You have all these cities with a city, you know, Ordos is the most famous one, with 20,000 people with 400,000 apartment buildings there. So, you know, why would people have traveled all the way, you know, to a remote place in Inner Mongolia to live there, you know, with, you know, twice as many people? So these are much more on the political side, on how the local government, the local officials are being promoted, you know, how they view themselves as being an effective leader. So long as the HR system doesn't change within the party, then so long as these people are always evaluated on their ostensible achievement on the GDP numbers, this will never change. So as for the corporate debt itself, I've been in finance for all these years. I've been constantly looking at it. I've never worried as much because CIC had, you know, is the major shareholder of all major banks, all the top four or five major banks. Every time when this thing come up and I go back again, check on our bank numbers, they say, well, we don't have as much of a problem, you know. But deep down, you know that there are many problems. But the thing is, these problems can be resolved since we're Chinese, you know, monetary system is still relatively a sort of a sealed-off system. So you don't have as much of a problem if you have the resolve to solve it on the other side. You start addressing the root problem rather than just the symptoms.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Judd Harriet. Could you discuss efforts to deepen capital markets, specifically interest rate liberalization?
So interest rate liberalization in principle is done. In practice, however, it's a different matter because whether you have a truly market-determined interest rate system depends on whether the banks do have this legacy problem taken off their books, and without that, it's hard to see them operating as purely commercial enterprises. Having said that, the legacy problem is really most important for the big banks rather than the smaller ones, which have a lesser of a legacy problem. There has been also indirect interest rate liberalization, especially of deposit rates through the wealth management products, even before they formally liberalized deposit rates, which created some risks of its own, of course. But in principle, interest rate liberalization is done. But I think all of this really doesn't work very well unless we deal with this problem, which is the debt overhang, and corporate debt is certainly a big concern. Like Mr. Gao, this is not a stay up at night kind of worry. It's not going to cause the system to come apart, but there is going to be a big price to be paid. And the question is, when is the government going to accept the fiscal cost? Because ultimately, in one way or the other, that's what it's going to come down to. I suspect that the problem is not as big as some in the private analyst community have made it out to be, but it is going to be somewhere in the range of 10 to 20% of GDP. If you think about the overall bad loans and deal with the fact that you're going to have partial asset recovery, you're going to have some of these loans paid off, the banks do have some degree of provisioning. So it's a big cost, but a manageable one. And here too, the government is trying these interesting and innovative strategies. Now, Ling Ling had a very nice piece in the Wall Street Journal about exactly the issue you spoke about. And although I do this with hesitation in terms of disagreeing from the Wall Street Journal, I think there is a slightly positive angle to this as well. What happened is basically that the government has taken debt that had been given to state enterprises, which were on the books of banks, and converted them into equity, still on the books of banks. And Ling Ling's piece correctly points out that this puts the squeeze on banks because now the equity has to be marked down in principle to market value. But the somewhat more positive spin on this is that at least it starts dealing with the legacy problem, because the difficulty of the legacy problem was that if you as a bank had made a loan to a state-owned enterprise, even if that state-owned enterprise was illiquid or insolvent, your incentive was to continue lending to that state enterprise because otherwise that loan showed up as an NPL on your books. Now it's gone into the equity market. It is going to be priced right, but you don't have an incentive as a bank to lend anymore. So it's a very inefficient way of trying to break that link. But here again, I think the government is approaching it with the right intentions of dealing with the legacy problem and trying to get the right price for those assets in the market. Again, is the equity market in China going to give you the right price for the assets? Probably not. But conceptually, I wouldn't dismiss it quite as quickly.
Can I just...
Go ahead.
I was just going to add briefly that China remains, you know, relatively closed to foreign investment and financial services. You know, it's partially open, and that's a separate issue from opening the capital account. And I think moving on that agenda would tend to make the financial system more robust. And it'll be tricky, but as you deal with some of these problems of bad debts, there will be some possibility to sell some of those banks and perhaps attract foreign investors to come in and take over some of those. It'll be a risky situation, but there's still tremendous interest in getting into China's domestic market.
In the past year also, we've been repeatedly hearing from the central government that they are going to let some banks or some major institutions to fall. You know, this we hear, you know, from time to time for a long time. And in our past 30 years of history, we never really had too many companies to really go bankrupt anyway. But this time, more and more people start to believe in it because you see so many companies really not just being zombie companies. They're really, you know, they're dead weight for the whole system. So people start to be gradually prepared for that sort of thing. And at the same time, I notice another development in the whole system, which is that last September last year, the Supreme Court came out with a whole line of what they call the explanation of the law, which officially, this is the Supreme Court. Now, they recognized a loan rate of 24% annually. This, you know, in our history, it was always regarded as usury rate, and it was always illegal. But now, finally, they're saying, okay, as long as it's a local, you know, it's contractual loans, so long as it's below 24%, the court would support it. So long as it's within 36%, if the parties agree to do it now, we won't say we'll support it, but we won't invalidated. So basically, they're saying that 36% annual interest rate is, you know, beyond that is illegal. This is, you know, this is a mind opening for a lot of people. People always say, okay, look at the official rate. It's always 6-7%. You're never allowed to do more, but the state banks or the major state enterprises are going to be able to get the 6% interest from the banks, then turn around, loan it to private enterprises. That's why the rates are so high. And it's a very inefficient system. So now that the court system recognizes it and the central government knows it, so you look at the past 30 years of history, gradually they're opening up. So I'm sure this sort of rate liberalization is going to go forward. We haven't so far yet to see any reversion on that department yet.
Okay. Sir? Yeah, in the back. Yeah, yes.
Thanks for a fascinating presentation. I'm Tom Switzer. I'm a State Department Foreign Service officer who's been to China several times and intrigued by this discussion. Dr. Dollar, you made a comment that in the course of your stay in China, there was relatively good communications between American and Chinese officers at the working level. But you then went on to comment that there even have been some exchanges between the two countries' people, but they apparently hadn't worked out that well. I guess my question is, are these all direct government-to-government exchanges, or have you brought in third parties? Have they brought in, like Fulbright and so on? And what are your recommendations going forward? Could there not be an increase in exchanges? Thank you.
So my comment was specifically a reference to the Federal Reserve System of the United States and People's Bank of China. And as I said, there was a couple of staff exchanges. I didn't mean to say that this didn't go well, but I don't think it's been continued or expanded to my knowledge. So, our Federal Reserve in the U.S. is interesting in that, we employ foreign citizens. So actually, I think there are some Chinese citizens who happen to be working in our Fed. That's just part of our normal system. But I was expressing the view that certainly when you're talking about, say, the research department, some of the study parts of central banks, seems to me be perfectly sensible to have exchanges of staff. Of course, you're not going to have foreign nationals involved in the operation of the policy setting committee. But then, as you yourself know, I think throughout the U.S. government, there are lots of other examples. I'm just trying to think back. As I said, I was representing Treasury. I don't recall that we had any staff exchanges with China. Seems to me that would actually be a useful thing. There are a lot of things that are done that are not confidential, and just in terms of confidence building, that would help a lot. It just seems to happen a lot more, say, in a think tank like Brookings and universities, that kind of place. Not too many examples in the government that I can think of.
I know this as a fact that the CSRC over the years had some of their staff members working with the SEC. And including the young woman who was there for a whole year, and then before she went back. So that sort of exchange has established a very solid person-to-person contacts.
We probably have time for one last question. Yes, sir. Gentleman with glasses. Yeah, right. You.
Сергей Костеев, Financial University, Moscow, Russia. It may be a question to the wrong audience, but anyway. Are revelations made in Panama Papers are going to have any ramifications for Chinese economic policy? Thanks.
What do I think about it? I don't even get to read it, so in China you don't get to read it, so
any other burning question? Yeah, please.
Yeah, Grand EGF Capital. I have a question with Mr. Gao. How strong or how seriously the capital control is now in China, and what's your outlook on it? Thank you.
Capital control, you mean capital account, current account, these things, right?
Right.
Okay. I think it's, people have the feeling that the government now is, especially from last year on, start to have exert a more sort of stringent rules on that. But I personally don't think it's going to happen because, there are these numbers, if you look at it. There are 50 million overseas Chinese today in the world, 50 million. And there are almost 3 million Chinese students in foreign countries. And last year, there were 120 million Chinese traveling outside of China. So with this sort of cross-border movement, how on earth, and our central bankers here, how can you possibly control these things? So that's why I'm very positive in that regard. I'm saying that despite of the ostensible control on the capital accounts, there's not going to be that much of control anyway. So it's not, many people predict that that after last year, they say, well, the central bankers are going to close the door and go back on their promise to open the capital account. I don't think that's going to happen. It won't happen because it's, you know, once you open the door, it's difficult to put it back in short of a revolution.
With those last words, we're ending today's session. Thank you very much for your great input.
So on behalf of the John L. Thornton Center on China and the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at Brookings, I want to welcome Yi Gang, the Deputy Governor of the People's Bank of China, to Washington and thank him for fitting us into his busy schedule. And I also want to thank Ben Bernanke, Distinguished Senior Fellow here at Brookings, former Chairman of the Federal Reserve, who is fighting a cold and didn't cancel, so we really appreciate that. I think, Governor Yi, when we listen today to the International Monetary Fund give a rather gloomy outlook for the world economy, talking about growth being too slow for too long, rising risk of financial instability, consternation at government policies aren't supportive enough of growth. I wonder, from your perch, what you think could improve the trajectory of the world economy? What should we do to do better?
I think we are here in town for the G20 meeting. I think the finance ministers and central bank governors now are here to try to discuss this million-dollar question.
Million RMB question.
Yes. And, I think policy coordination is very important, like they did in Shanghai. What I can say here is that from the first quarter data, I can see that China economy is in the pretty robust in a lot of indicators in terms of transportation, in terms of electricity, in terms of CPI, PPI, and other indicators. So that I think that China will release its first quarter GDP data very soon. And if U.S. economy, I would say that still within the expectation grows at maybe around 2% range. And the second largest economy in China, I'm pretty confident that we are going to have 6.5 to 7% growth this year. If the two largest economy economic picture is pretty much within the expectation, I would say that we have a solid foundation to continue to fight this weak demand. Mm-hmm. And maybe for the global economy, we can continue to through the coordination of macroeconomic policy and through the reform and structural reform, and can restore trade and restore growth.
What do you think the biggest risk to that scenario is?
I think that right now, even some international organization lower the global growth outlook. But historically speaking, if you look at the past decade and past two decades, we are still around the average of the growth rate. So that there is nothing panic. And I think on one hand, we really have this very solid macroeconomic policy, including fiscal policy and monetary policy. On the other hand, we also should not exaggerate the risk and overreact. That's another risk. I would say that the most difficult thing is reform. If you really want to do some reform, it's difficult. People can have, say, quantitative easing. They can have physical deficit and try to pump up the economy in a short time, have a quick result. But compared to the real structural reform, supply side reform, you have to solve your, say, labor market problem. You have to solve a lot of like property rights and fundamental, deep rooted problems. I think not reform is a risk, and overreact is another risk.
Mm-hmm. Overreact, yeah. So, Dr. Bernanke, what would be your recipe for having a somewhat better trajectory for the global economy?
Let me first agree with the governor that we're far better off than we were a few years ago. But the growth overall is still fairly disappointing for different reasons. In advanced industrial economies, there's still some cases of trying to overcome insufficient demand and try and hit inflation targets. In the emerging markets, they're dealing with a combination of some slower growth in China, declines in commodity prices, a stronger dollar. So there's a whole bunch of factors that are relevant there. I don't have any magic formula, but I guess a few points I would make. One would be in those countries which are still struggling with aggregate demand deficiency, there should be a better balance between monetary and fiscal policy. Currently, in some countries, the central banks are carrying an awfully large part of the load. And
You mean China and U.S.
I'm thinking primarily of Europe and Japan as well. And a better fiscal monetary balance would be desirable. The structural reform is important, and it's a little bit of a mantra. You know, people always say, well, structural reform, and that is critical, particularly, of course, for emerging markets like China. But I think there has to be smart reform. And in particular, in countries where there is deficient demand, some reforms are not so effective. For example, reforms that allow you to fire workers more easily may not be so beneficial when you have high unemployment. What should be the focus should be policies that increase productivity and the incentive to invest. So that creates both demand and supply, so to speak. The other point I would make, and this is something that became increasingly important in these international meetings when I participated in them, is financial and banking relationships. I think that if you think about the United States and its vulnerability to developments abroad, it's less issues of trade and foreign growth than it is the way the financial markets are reflecting uncertainties globally. And so I think, you know, continued emphasis on cooperation and supervision, financial regulation, particularly with emerging markets who have sometimes taken a second seat to the advanced economies and financial coordination, I think that's an important direction as well.
Governor Yi, I think there's still a lot of worry in global markets and among policymakers that we could have a bad outcome in China. And I think one specific part of the worry has to do with the currency, the risk, continued risk, that there will be a large devaluation of the RMB. Now, markets have been pretty calm lately. You've done a good job at discouraging speculation that a large devaluation is imminent. But I think there's still some confusion about precisely how you look at the foreign exchange regime. What is it that you want people to understand about how you're managing the currency?
The official statement of our exchange rate is it is based on the market supply and demand. And using a basket of currencies as a reference, managed floating regime. That has the major three key part of the statement. One is it has to demand and the supply driven. It's a market based. That's the first part. The second part is using a basket of currencies as reference. Then the third part is a managed floating regime. I think that is still probably the most precise statement that I can say. Right now, the market activity has been coming down quite a bit. What I want to say is that we have been relatively successful to convey the message. It's with a basket of currencies as a reference. But in the basket, U.S. dollar still has a very large weight, which means that if they say the renminbi is a stable reference to a basket, and also it's relatively stable relative to U.S. dollar, right? So that I think what I want to say is that the market force is still the number one consideration, number one factor. But at this stage, I think the tremendous market volatility or overshoot scenario is not good for China, is not good for the rest of the world, especially in a situation when the global demand is weak. And I think we want to, on one hand, still considering the market supply and demand. On the other hand, we don't want to see an overshooting scenario. So that if you look at the current account, if you look at FDI and ODI, I would say that RMB is within the range of more or less equilibrium level. So that in terms of fundamental, I have the confidence that we can still have a fairly stable exchange rate.
But isn't there some tension between saying you want the market to set the value of the currency, but you also want it to be stable? Aren't those sometimes at war with each other?
Yes, I think so. Yes, you have to weigh the benefit and the cost. If you look at the chart, and you can see that I would say that in the long run, it's still market based is the number one factor you have to mm-hmm. consider.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bernanke, we learned from economists that it's hard, if not impossible, for a country to have an independent monetary policy, an open flow of capital, and a fixed exchange rate at the same time. And sometimes it looks like China's trying to weigh those three things against each other and have its three out of three. What do you think that China needs to do to make its exchange rate commitments more credible?
Well, first, while there is market elements. Of course, there is an important element of management also, which I think, given all the other things going on in Chinese economic policy, is probably pretty inevitable. The PBOC has been pretty clear that a sharp decline in the value of the renminbi is not desirable or likely, and making that clear in itself was helpful because it reduced some of the speculation against the RMB. So as you point out, China's facing the so-called trilemma of trying simultaneously to have independent monetary policy, free capital flows, and at least partly managed, managed exchange rate. I think that they will be able to meet their objectives. In particular, on the capital flow side, the last speaker in the previous session was saying that reducing capital freedom is not likely, and I agree with that, or desirable. But there are things that can be done, for example, to increase desirability of investment in China by both domestic investors and foreign investors. And the recent opening of the bond market, for example, is one example of a way to bring more cash into the country. Further deregulation of domestic investments would be another thing. So I think the main potential contradiction is between avoiding depreciation and monetary ease. And so my recommendation, and I've written about this on a Brookings blog, my recommendation to China would be to focus more on what I call targeted fiscal policy, that is to use fiscal policy as a way of achieving the level of demand, which doesn't have quite the negative effects for the currency that monetary policy can have. But at the same time, use that fiscal policy to advance the goals of reform. So in particular, in order to create a more consumer-led economy, you need to improve the social safety net so people be more willing to spend and not save so much. You need to increase disposable income, through tax cuts. You need to reallocate labor from the heavy industry sector to the services sector, which, again, is a fiscal challenge. So I think that the getting the monetary fiscal mix right in order to support the currency objectives is consistent with reform goals, and that would be the sort of the framework that I would encourage.
Dr. Bernanke has made the point, as has his successor, Janet Yellen, that in the United States there's been a tendency to rely too much on monetary policy and fiscal policy not being helpful enough. Do you ever feel that that's the way it is in China?
In China, fiscal policy is very important. For example, this year we are going to increase our deficit ratio to 3% of GDP, so that our fiscal deficit for this year will be over 2 trillion renminbi, 3% relative to GDP. Mm-hmm. Last year it was 2.3%, so that I think the proactive fiscal policy in China is very important. Coming back to your trilemma question, I think People's Bank of China, we have independent, more or less independent monetary policy, because China is a large country. We need monetary policy to decide domestic interest rate and so on and so forth. Capital account convertibility, you see, our capital account is to a large degree convertible. But you see, during the situation of a crisis or some abnormal situation, we can still have some management mm-hmm. on the capital account. For the stable exchange rate, we are not having a fixed exchange rate. And if you look at the past 10 years, for example, starting from 2005, you see 2005, the exchange rate was 8.28 renminbi to a dollar, right? And if you look at the past 11 years, if you look at the RER and NER, renminbi appreciate RER and NER in the
real
order of
real effective exchange rate.
Yeah, real effective exchange rate or nominal effective exchange rate. Appreciate in the order of 30% to 40% in the past 10 years, right? And if you compare to last year and say the year before, actually this time renminbi appreciated all the way to 6.05, and now is 6.50. So that still, you see, to a certain degree, renminbi is still floating, mm-hmm. right? That kind of exchange rate adjustment, exchange rate floating, primarily driven by the market force, that help to balance the economy mm-hmm. and to absorb some shocks, right? So that the Trinity dilemma, it says that for the independent monetary policy, capital account, convertibility, and the stable exchange rate, you cannot have three. You can have only two. But you can have a combination of the three, and theoretically you can prove there is a mm-hmm. Triangle. And what we say is that the overall distance from a point to the edge of the triangle, the sum is equal to 2, is possible. It's possible. Which means that you can, between the three, you can have the combination of the three make the sum of the three equal to 2.
I see.
Yeah. You know.
I'm going to have to work this out with a little geometry after the summer.
That is different from in certain variable. You, the only truth is 0 or 1.
I see.
Right.
Yeah.
So that that is just one combination. But theoretically, there are infinite combinations that we can choose.
I see.
What my job is, we try to, you see, try to consider optimal or suboptimal combination of the three.
So do you have a little calculator on your desk that helps you make sure that your adds up to 2 and not to 2.1 or 1.9?
Yeah. I already prove that. Yeah, 20 years ago.
I see.
That's the work I was
your academic.
Ever make changes of 27 basis points, right? Which is three cubed.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're putting your academic research to such practical use.
Yes.
One thing that, if you look at what's going on in the world economy, I'd say that there are two things that get the most attention. One is what you're doing at the People's Bank of China, and the other is what the Federal Reserve is up to. Mm. So the Federal Reserve has begun the process of normalizing interest rates. It's moving a little more slowly than it and a lot of people had anticipated, but they're moving in that direction. At the same time, we see increasingly easy monetary policy in Europe, in Japan, and not quite sure what's happening in the UK. They seem to be frozen at the moment. Does this divergence of monetary policy outside of China and the normalization of rates in the U.S., do you feel that this is creating difficulties for you and China?
Yes, it's somewhat challenging. But you see, the monetary policy is primarily based on domestic mm-hmm. consideration, although the important central bank should consider the spillover effect. I think...
You mean the Fed? Or are you talking about the People's Bank?
I think that the important central bank, the right formula is you make decision primarily based on the domestic consideration, but for the important ones, you should consider the spillover effect. I think the current situation, as you described, the ECB and the Bank of Japan, and also Federal Reserve, and also People's Bank of China, I think they communicate and coordinate fairly well, and we understand of each other, and we have an effective channel of communication. I think so far,
we can still manage to make the picture by and large stable.
So do you think the Fed takes into consideration sufficiently the spillover effects?
That's a question to Ben. I think he has the best capability.
Do you think that some emerging markets, not Governor Yi, but as you know, Governor Rajan of India and others have said that the Fed is not sufficiently sensitive to the impact that Fed policy has. To what extent do you think there really are big spillovers from what the Fed does to emerging market economies?
Are you talking to me now? Oh. Can I discuss the triangle part first? Well, there are spillovers, of course. I think that the Federal Reserve does pay attention to what's happening in the world. The United States is part of the global economy. There's feedback of all different kinds, both real and financial. So it's very important for the Fed to pay attention globally. At the same time, the Fed can't make monetary policy for the world. It's in the interest of the world for the U.S. to have stable, you know, non-inflationary growth. That's what the Fed is trying to achieve. And what you observe is that other countries are affected by Fed policy to a varying degree according to their own decisions. I would take an example of a country which has managed pretty well is Mexico, which is right on our border. But they've got sound monetary and fiscal policies. They've got a reasonably flexible exchange rate. They've got a strong financial system, and they have, you know, it's in their interest, obviously, Mexicans' interest, to see the U.S. economy growing in a healthy way. So it's really, I think, responsibility on both sides. I mean, the Fed has to think about the global environment and the effects of its decisions, if no other reason, then that's going to feed back on the U.S. economy. But the what happens globally does depend an awful lot on choices that are made by the other economies as well.
Ari, there's been concern expressed both outside and inside China. Governor Zhou at his speech at the China Development Forum about the problem of rising leverage in the corporate sector in China. Zombie firms that are kept alive by banks that just keep rolling over the loans because they don't want to recognize the losses. Two questions. Do you see this as a risk to the Chinese economy? And if so, what's the solution to this so you don't end up with some of the problems with debts that we've seen in some Western economies?
I do realize that the debt of corporate sector in China is relatively high compared to other developing countries. I think solution is that one thing you really have to have the financial discipline to make every enterprise, every unit of the economy to be responsible for themselves, right? If they bankrupt, they bankrupt. And that is the financial discipline is very important. The property rights is very important. And the market, the nature of market economy is that the unit of the market has to responsible for their behavior and for their investment. That is the most important. If that is not true, then there are a lot of moral hazard, right? The other thing I want to say is that given the corporate sector's leverage ratio is already relatively high, we have to consider this problem or alleviate this problem in a very gradual manner so that it probably, you see, it still take time to make it stable and then maybe decline. But it's not realistic to say you want to have some policy to immediately decrease the leverage ratio. That is not realistic. So you really have to do it very careful, and you really have to consider the government leverage ratio and family, household leverage ratio, and corporate leverage ratio, and the leverage ratio for the economy as a whole. And you have to look at this whole picture and try to optimize and find a smooth solution.
How well do you think China is doing on what you, your first point, in making individual borrowers responsible for their debts?
I think we still have some reform to do, to go. For example, we have to strengthen our bankruptcy law, and we should speed up the simplify and speed up the procedure for the bankruptcy process. And that, if you have a good legal environment, that make people's expectation more stable, so that make the process more efficient.
Dr. Bernanke, are there any lessons that China should learn from our experience with the last decade of credit, too much credit, and then?
Well, let me first say that while leverage is very high in China, including not just corporations but regional governments and others as well, that there's a couple of ameliorating factors. One is that unlike some emerging markets, China's debt, for the most part, is in local currency. There's about $1 trillion of dollar-denominated corporate debt, I believe. But most of the debt is in local currency, and so there's not the exchange rate risk that the other some other countries have faced. Also, it's funded mostly by domestic savings and pretty sticky savings as well, going through the banking system, for example. So that means that we don't really see the risk of a capital flight in the same way that you might see in the 90s and the Asia crisis, for example. The other factor is that the Chinese government has resources, and while I appreciate the point that borrowers should stand on their own two feet, so to speak, should there be a systemic problem, I think the China government has the resources necessary to address that. And indeed, I think a useful direction would be to stop using banks sort of as an indirect arm of fiscal policy and to separate much more cleanly fiscal action and credit, which would simplify some of this in the future. In terms of lessons, I think the main lesson I would suggest is not about the run-up to the problem, but sort of the response to the problem. I think that one can at least make the case that the U.S. did a pretty good job of cleaning up the banks and getting them back into healthy condition quickly. We put capital in the banks. We did stress tests and the like. And so competing with the view that you should be very gradual, which I also understand, is also an argument in a market economy for just trying to get the problem fixed. And the Japanese took a very long time, you know, in the 90s to address their banking problems, for example. So the extent that the problems are severe enough, and this may not be the case in China, but to the extent that the problems are severe enough that they erode confidence in the banking system, then sometimes a really quick response and, you know, rapid recovery is more effective.
So if you could ask Ben Bernanke one question, what would it be?
Of course, it's the direction of U.S. monetary policy.
Lots of luck with that.
Yeah, well, I'm not in charge of that anymore, as you know.
I thought you would say that it would be prudent.
It'll certainly be prudent and careful, yes.
Yeah. And was there a question you'd like to ask Governor Yi before I turn to the audience?
Well, let's see. So how do you think that this critical growth model reform, going from the heavy industry, from exports, you know, that kind of model to growth, to the model you're trying to get to, one which has consumer-led services, those, that's a very tricky transition.
Yeah.
And
how do you see that as going, and what do you see as the main barrier to that? And what kind of time frame are we thinking about?
I think it probably take several years for this transition. But what I can say now is the transition is going on right now. For example, last year, our GDP growth rate is 6.9 GDP growth rate, whereas the consumption contribution to this incremental is about 66%, which is consumption contribution is about two-thirds of the growth. And also, if you look at the composition of the economy, China used to, the manufacturer sector for Chinese economy used to be the largest. And in the past several years, the service sector, or we say tertiary industry, is much larger, have a much faster growth rate. Last year, the service sector already beyond 50% of GDP, so that it's more than 10 percentage point higher than the manufacturer sector. So in terms of the structure of the economy, service sector has been grow most rapid sector, and also service sector is more labor-intensive sector. The employment in the recent years has been very good in China. And consumption is relatively stable. But as I said, that last year, the contribution of the consumption to GDP growth is about two-thirds. So all this indication point to the direction that China already on the transition from heavy industry and export-oriented economy to consumer-driven economy. But still, it take several years to finish this process. The difficulty is that, as you correctly point out, China's saving rate is relatively high, probably one of the highest in the world. And for the very high saving, and you have to invest, or you either abroad or domestic invest, which means that the investment as a percentage of GDP is relatively high. How do you solve that the consumption-driven economy, probably the consumption percentage as a percentage of GDP should be much higher, but on the same consideration, you have to find out how you deal with the very high saving rate. I think that is a question that we have to figure out.
I think we have time for some questions. Do we have a mic? Anybody, Eshwar, do you want to take the first question?
Governor Yi, you've spoken about how China wants to move towards a more flexible exchange rate. What do you see as the end game here? What is the monetary policy framework that you think is going to be suitable for China as it adapts to a more open capital account, a more flexible exchange rate, a different structure of the economy?
You mean monetary policy framework? I think that our monetary policy framework is still in a transition. And for example, now we still consider the money supply. Say M2 is still a forecast target. It's not a mandatory target, but still a forecast target. At the same time, we also think that interest rate is very important. We already somewhat established the preliminary stage of interest rate corridor or something similar to interest rate corridor. So that I think if you, on one hand, still consider the money supply, the aggregate money supply, on the other hand, you realize that interest rate is very important in the transmission mechanism. And also you know that theoretically the two actually you have to coordinate between the two. To answer your question, I think the same dilemma we're facing is also the trilemma problem, the exchange rate problem. And the whole economy is in transition, like from the investment and export-led model to a consumption-led model. The monetary policy framework in the transition from heavily depend on the quantitative variable to more emphasize on the interest rate price variable. And you see the exchange rate regime is also in the transition. I think my point is that right now my number one consideration is manage those transitions. Of course, you say if you don't have a final goal, how can you manage the transition? I think that the final goal is fairly clear. The final goal is fairly clear, except probably there are some dimension that is more subtle and is difficult to describe.
Krishna, did you have a question? Stand up so the mic can find you.
Krishna Guha, Evercore Partners. I wanted to ask again also about the exchange rate. You've done made significant efforts in recent months to communicate more about the exchange rate. I think it's better understood. And yet there's still a source of confusion that you talk about the currency with reference to the basket. And yet in recent months we've seen the currency not stable against the CETS basket, but continually depreciating on average. So can you enlighten us, if you're setting the exchange rate with reference to the basket, why it is that it's not stable against that basket, but appears to be trending against the basket? Thank you.
That's a good question. I have explained that quite in detail. Just directly to tell, try to answer your question. We consider three major baskets. One is CFIS basket. The second one is BIS basket. The third one is SDR basket. All the three is under our consideration. We say with a reference to a basket. We don't say peg to a basket. Right, with a reference to a basket, that explains itself. The other thing is you mentioned the CFIS basket, and I think if you look at the data, you can see that it a little bit off the basket, but the base period of CFIS basket is the end of 2014. And 2014 was a relatively high point for renminbi. As I said, that in the last 10 years, that the NER and RER of renminbi appreciate 30 to 40% in that range. Whereas the end of 2014 was the high point of this process. And it really, to answer your question, it really depend on the time window you consider. If you consider the past 3 years as a moving average as a window, it's a different conclusion. If you consider the past 5 years moving average as the time window, you have a different average. That's different, and so that can answer part of your question. The other part of the question is answered by if you cannot explain the situation, and you have to explain the situation by the market demand and supply. As I said, that my belief is that market supply and demand is first factor in the process of determining exchange rate, right? And if the market is stable, right, you really have to give the market demand and supply more weight, right? And that's my philosophy and that's my belief.
A question here.
Thank you. Again, in reference to the exchange rate, I want to see if I understand correctly your position. So there's a lot of nervousness, right, about the exchange rate policy. But is it fair to say that with respect to the trilemma specifically, given that it's not desirable to close the capital account for a variety of reasons, having an exchange rate that moves in the direction that the markets wanted to move, not entirely because that would be too much, but in that direction, would help the conduct of monetary policy, will free up the carrying out of an independent monetary policy, regardless of whether the sum of the triangle is 2 or whatever you want. So if that is true, why should we be afraid of, whenever China, the renminbi devalues? Doesn't that mean that China is doing exactly the same thing that every other central bank has done or would do in its place, which is to support a weakening economy with easier monetary policy, and the result of that is a weakening exchange rate. Maybe the sequence is different. First the exchange rate, then the free, easy monetary policy instead of vice versa, but isn't that what China is trying to do?
I think that was a yes-no question.
I think if I understand your question correctly, your question is basically we should let the market decide, period, right? I think, you see, if you look at the literature of exchange rate and you see a lot of overshooting model, you see a lot of multiple equilibrium model, I would say that for China, it's a significant economy. And also, we have, say, G20 and other platform of cooperation. I would say that maintain the relative stability is good for China and good for the rest of the world. If you look at the major investment prediction on renminbi last year, and if you look at their prediction, the magnitude of one direction bet of the major financial institution, I think they have very smart economists, and they have a base, a model to produce the result. But it turns out that if you look at the past year's data, and it has been relatively stable. And we manage relatively stable. And I can tell you that right now, the pressure has been reduced, significantly reduced. I would say that the current outcome is better than a free float model.
There's a woman here on the aisle. Let's take two, and once you pass it to the woman on your left, sure. And we'll take both questions.
Thank you. I'm Jennifer Lee with Hong Kong Phoenix TV. A question for Government Yi and Dr. Bernanke. It's about China's financial regulators. So due to the market turbulence earlier this year, the talks of how to coordinate the three regulators reemerged, which include the regulators of security, bank, and insurance companies. We even hear the talks about establishing super central banks to better coordinate the three regulators. So I wonder what's Government Yi's point of view on that, and do you think how the central bank can play a role in dealing with financial instability? And for Dr. Bernanke, do you think how China can derive their experience from the Western countries in terms of structure or coordination to better dealing with the financial instability or even when the financial crisis comes?
Right. Why don't you pass it to your left and we'll take that question as well.
I'm Zhang Yuzhen with Xinhua News Agency. The IMF has expressed his concern about some of China's stimulus might hurt the quality of the economic growth, and so how China can strike a balance between ensuring stable growth and controlling the risk. And the second question is about the SDR. And Governor Zhou Xiaochuan is proposing the greater use of the SDR. And how do you see this kind of proposal, and what's the relevance between the greater use of the SDR and the internationalization of the Chinese yuan? Thank you.
I thought I was getting two questions, and I think I got six. let's start with
Ben first.
What advice do you have them on structuring their bank regulation other than don't do it the way we do?
Well, that was going to be my answer. No. Well, I mean, the United States has a particularly complicated financial system, which is partly a choice and partly it is an accident. But we have a trade-off, which is that given our complex financial system, that we have different specializations, so to speak. You know, the SEC specializes in securities markets, and the FDIC and the OCC specialize in banking and so on. So there's skill sets there. At the same time, it is very important that there be close coordination. The Fed tries to act as a coordinator. There are councils of coordinator among bank regulators. And then, of course, the Dodd-Frank Act created the Financial Stability Oversight Council. So whether it's the right balance, I don't know. The regulatees think not. The banks think that they are overregulated by too many different points of view. Another way of looking at that is that you have more eyes, maybe is better than only a few eyes. So there's a trade-off between having specialized regulators providing independent points of view versus the coordination and efficiency of, you know, working together. And I can't be much more general than that. I think that we do try in the United States to have coordination, but obviously we fail sometimes.
And what's your view on how coordinated, is the coordination adequate in China, and what would you do to make it better?
I can only answer that question in principle. I think in principle you have to consider first information. Yeah, you see, you have to consider the information is there is an efficient transmission of information, efficient usage of information. Those who have the responsibility, who have accountability, who have the power and should have the information. That's one criteria. The second criteria is you have to design the mechanism to make the responsibility and their power to be symmetric. If you have somebody have power but they are not responsible for the consequence, that's no good. That's my answer to your regulatory question. For the SDR question, I think SDR was created in 1960s. I think still there are some potential usage for SDR, for example, in terms of reporting, like BIS reporting in terms of SDR. And also, there is a potential SDR-denominated asset market. There are some benefit and also some cost. If some international organization or some central bank or some private institution find out that it's more convenient to use SDR, there is a potential broader usage of SDR.
Thank you. I'm afraid we're out of time. I'd like to ask a favor. This room is going to be set up for another event immediately afterwards, so if you could take any papers at your seat and put them in the recycling, we'd appreciate that, and we'd like to clear the room as quickly as possible. Please join me in thanking Governor Yi and Governor.